going to interview George Magnuson at about 7:10 in the evening. I'm at George's house here in Kodiak. George lives a little bit off of Benny Benson, close to Resinoff. George, would you tell us a little bit about some of the important things that have happened to you in your life? No, not in too much detail, but you can give us a rundown.
Okay. Like I said, I was born here in 1918. And in the 30s, I worked on cannery canvas with my dad. And got to learn the boat trade, cannery for the canneries. And that's about the occupation of Kodiak in those days. It was seasonal, just no winter, just during the summer months. And that's where I got my start in boating. Of course, then we developed into the In 1937, I was running a boat, and so was my dad, and we were doing the dredging and surveying for seeing Drake out here at the base. We originally started at the base and soon in preparation for World War II. And that was the start of it. Of course, when the war did start, I didn't get into the service directly, but I was working for government, and I was going both around the island here, serving on the outposts and the troops that were placed in different places, like the searchlight groups, in your gunnery placements, and took their supplies, and like I said, towed targets one. That's what the extent of my war years here.
Okay, before we get too far into that, George, let's answer some of these other questions. One I want to answer maybe right now. You mentioned dredging. Where and what were you dredging for? Was that out in Women's Bay or where?
Yes, that was Women's Bay. That was a shallow fishing bay before. They used to take 2 to 3 million fish out of that Women's Bay every summer from anywhere from June 15th to August 15th, that was the fishing season here, the season of work.
George, I want to back up to your family. How did your family end up coming to Kodiak? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, then my father came from Norway. He left Norway when he was 17 years old. And he came over here and got into the American Revenue Cutter Service, which is now called the Coast Guard. And that's how he got his citizenship, and that's when he started out on the East Coast, and he got on the regular cutter man, which is serving in Alaska together, and that's how he came to the West Coast here, where he met my mother. Of course, my grandfather came from Norway also, so that's where that connection came in. And of course, I was born and raised here.
Okay, what year were you born in Kodiak?
I was born December 25th, 1918.
Okay, you've kind of given us a little bit of a picture about what Women's Bay at least was like before the war. How about the town of Kodiak? What do you remember the town before they started making any preparations for the war?
Well, it was a small fishing town, I venture to say. You're in between 250 to 400 people in that area, population area. And it was only seasonal. It was like all from April and May, getting the cannery ready and driving the fish traps. And then fishing with the regular fishermen for June, July, August, as well as the traps. And then in September, everything closed up again for the winter. So there was nothing else after that. It was seasonal.
How many canneries were here before the war?
Well, right in Kodiak, there was only the one. It was called Kodiak Fisheries Company. This island was named originally Kodiak Island, and then kept on Kodiak Island. There was one more, kind of smaller, kind of away from there, which was Yuzinki, which was about 45 minutes long from there. And there was also the McConaughey cannery down here at the dock. Where the city dock is, not the city dock, but the ferry dock is now located. That was just a small plant too, and we did clams as well as salmon and herring.
Uh-huh. besides salmon and herring, and what were some of the other fisheries that were important to people at that time?
Well, at that time, the only three was the salmon, the herring, and the clams. Locally, the halibut, the boats had come up from Seattle, they hit the halibut and go south with it. The crabbing didn't come in until after the war. 60s? After the war. And they were big ones. They were anywhere from 20 to 26 pounders. And you couldn't sell them for $1.50 a piece, the whole crab.
Uh-huh. Times have changed. How old were you when the actual war started, when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor?
Yeah, 23 years old, right there.
And what were you doing at that time? Were you actually working on the dredging that you were talking about?
Well, during the summer months, like I said, I had been on the... No, I hadn't been on the tender.
Hate to put in your microphone, but at that time you were working for Ray Martin, and then shortly after the war started, and you got started on the
Army. Oh, that's right. I worked in the craft store, and then I worked in the liquor store before I got into the Army service. That was in 41. 41 to 40, 44.
And after you did that, you started helping by doing what?
Well, that's the time I was doing the military service, hauling the supplies, the groceries and the ammunition supplies around the different outposts around the island, like over to Marmot Island, over down to Alatak, and Long Island. We had Danger Bay and Larson Bay and Ocean Beach on the east side.
Okay, yeah, tell us. You can't hear on a tape recorder probably, but George's wife says something about, tell him about the submarine gate, so we want to make sure we get this.
Well, what we had submarine nets stretch across. We're here not very far from where the net started. It's Mission Beach here, right across to Woody Island. On one end was an entrance wide enough for a boat to go through, and it's the metal mesh, just like a big sediment, except they were, I'd say, three feet by 4 feet. And they were put there for, of course, to keep submarines out of the area from coming in, because if it was shallow enough, they would have the surface anyhow. Nevertheless, the net was across here. And you could only come through here in daytime. You could not come into Kodiak during the nighttime at all. Then at the other entrance, between Thick Point or Broad Point, they call it. That's from the base of South Entrance, over toward Long Island, was a minefield. And you had to know where you were going to get through that minefield, because all the local boats knew where they were. They could go through it, but they couldn't. Otherwise, you'd be in the edge of the mine district across there for a couple of 3 years. Also, lay the first pair. 50 pair of telephone underwater cable, and the Kodiak Island area offices to Chiniac, over to Long Island, and then over to Puffin Island, and then over to the base, and then over on the Nashville Bay side, which is out here, just about 15 minutes ride from here. They laid a telephone cable from there over to Seward. And I was running a boat at that time, and we had 90 tons on board, and that's the equivalent of about 123-mile run to Seward, and that held us till we got about 6 hours out of Seward, and we run at the end of the cable. Of course, you have to hang on to it, you can't let it go. And we had to wait till we had a Canadian cable ship at the store. She came up alongside, and she grabbed that end, and they spliced it. It took 8 hours to splice the rest of the cable, and then it went on into Johnson Cape, and bring it to sort from there to then, which was about 225 miles long.
How big a boat did you take out that was laying?
Mine was a 85-foot power boat.
Okay, what are some of the other wartime projects that bring back memories for you that happened in Kodiak during the war?
Well, of course, there was rationing here. The one particular thing I didn't care for was torn targets, of course, because they weren't too accurate, and I guess that's why they had to practice. It wasn't very easy torn because on several instances they were pretty close to, I don't want to hit it, but they used the HE shell, which is a high explosive, with a shrapnel on the side of the boat. And you had to tow going from Cape Chiniac toward Marmot Island, because when the bullets came through, lightning, they ricocheted off to the right, so you had to tow north so that the shell would bear off to the south. But if you did the other way, you were right in that line of turning, trajectory.
Yeah, a person wouldn't think about that unless I guess they had to put up with the live ammunition coming from the planes.
It was from the
ships?
From the shore batteries.
Oh, I see.
They were Long Island, out here at New Bay Point, out here, Fort Abercrombie. Those were. And by the way, those guns came off of the ships, warships in World War I. The 8-inch, 6-inch, 6-8 and 4-inch. And then they had the smaller ones that used the high explosive trajectory, which was right off. Just as you leave the base where you get by Lake Louise, at the dump area or where the tents are, there used to be a battery of guns for aircraft, firing into aircraft if you came in over the runway. And those were wet tow for them too. They were pretty wild, of course. When they did, you could see the fire coming out of the gun barrel. And it was done daytime. But you could see this. And then the agony of waiting until you hear the crack of the sound, you know, that it passed you. But until that time, it was coming towards you. So that was had a little bit of the waiting. You get used to that. And we also had rationing. I know that the gals used to stand in line a lot for that for the stockings. And there was an alcoholic in line. There was only so many quarts of cases of booze and beer and wine, whatever. And there'd be one line but for 4 hours, and of course it was clean up. And then they'd wait till the next ship, which could be 3 weeks. We had tire rationing. Food shortage wasn't too bad. There was sugar, but wasn't that the shortage? Sugar. But I remember also laying at the dock, and we'd take some of these rations that had been evidently got old or stored, and got like sugar, 50 pound sacks, hard enough. We had almost a half a scull over. Couple 300, 400 sacks of it, and just took it out here and dumped it. It was just like cement. Quite a bit that they threw away, and then people found it being rationed. And we had an officer with us to make sure we did that. We didn't
want any black market sugar.
We didn't want any. Whatever you had.
Which branches of the service seemed to play an important part on Kodiak Island?
This was the Army. That's who I.
Okay. Where was the Army headquartered, do you remember?
Well, it's what, you know, what is now the base housing area used to be called Fort Greeley. And that's right up here as you pass Lake Louise, these houses that are sitting out there. That's where Army Town was. Well, the other thing I did in the spare time, not only running the smaller 85-foot boat that I was on, but also bringing in the 250-foot, 300-foot piloting them into the Kodiak troop transport. This was for the Kiska ADAC invasion that I was in China out there. We had as high as 34 to 37,000 troops sitting out here. They were in tents. Of course, also, I used to, the other spare time we had, we took him, I ran over here to Danger Bay, which is about 30 miles from here. It was a swamp. Built by the Army Corps of Engineers. And I'd bring in lumber, a load of lumber, maybe every 3 or 4 days, between all this other stuff. And he'd start building these wooden barracks out here before he got into tents. Now, all the troops that we had here, you know, approximately 6,000 casualties came back through, but it wasn't from any injury other than, I mean, not from bullets, it was frostbite. Most of these boys were from California and Florida and Georgia and Alabama and those places. And of course, the Kodiak boys that got drafted, sent them down state to the warm area instead of leaving us, the boys up here who knew this country and knew the chain and the climatic conditions and the fog and the snow and all this, were very well acclimated. Here they have to go down and fight the heat and bring these poor fellows out from the heat up here to this cold. And it was quite a bit of problems with the frostbite.
Was there a hospital on the island for those soldiers?
Well, they had a small infirmary. Most of them were brought in and transported out again. The ships came in. I'd have to go up and pilot one in about every second or third day. They came in a couple at a time. They didn't all come at one time. It was a staggered thing so that if there's any submarines in the area, which they had reported any Japanese submarines in the area, but that they wouldn't catch them. We didn't lose any of them by Japanese.
Okay. Do you remember any of the more renowned wartime personnel, or was there anybody that worked in the services that maybe he wasn't a general or even an officer? Are there any special personnel you remember that were on Kodiak, and why do you remember them?
Well, one I certainly remember, and I've got to say he's an officer, was Captain Ole Johnson, who was Gary Stevens' father-in-law. He was the communications officer for this. The 250th Coast Artillery. And he was one of the gentlemen that I was throwing targets for. His job was relaying he had communication. He was relaying how the bullets were landing in the water, went up or down. That's where the trouble was mostly. They weren't so bad with the up or down, wasn't too bad, but it was the front and back part we had trouble with, because this is the stuff that he was dealing with. And on the power barge, I had, plus my own crew, there were about four soldiers. They had what you call a bow and arrow type of thing, like a Robinson Crusoe here. It was just a crossbow with a T on it, and it was a nail, every inch here, so about 30 here, and then a center mark, and 30 off to the left again. And it's called a range rake. They stick it like this and they watch where the boat lands from behind. You can see what splashes in the water. And then they report. And they're sitting back the shoreside to where this range was working. And that's how they got to coordinate the firing on the guns. Anybody else? There was a lot of work. Henry Eaton was one of them. He was around here. Plus, I knew just about everybody locally that we could hear, just Charlie Madsen, Ben Craft, and most of the people that were in Kodiak at that time.
One of them I'm going to talk to, I hope, is Betty Springhill. I know she's just. She wasn't in the Army or anything, was she?
No. Well, she was a school teacher here. When did she come here?
I don't know if she was here.
I don't think she was here during the war period. This was after that.
No, she came here about 1935 or
Okay. How did the war personally affect your own family? Were there any changes that big changes in your family, how they lived, or?
No. The only problem that I, when you're going out on a boat like this, and of course it always had the threat of the Japanese coming over and bombing, and they'd have to leave town and go out, come out here toward Abercrombie and stay out of the area. So we were out with the boats. We were all spotted too, because they're talking to Japanese ships.
Well, that one incident when my first child was born, and it was early along the
My first daughter was born. December 27, 1941. And that was the night, first night that the silent blew in Kodiak for in preparations for the Japanese air. It was 8 o'clock in the evening. She was born 10 minutes to 8. So it was a little bit of excitement there for me, because I didn't have any transportation, so I ran all the way from the hospital in town, which is the Griffin Memorial, that's the old memorial there, that's the bus stand to go out, ran all the way out here to the beach from this, and that, in those days, you know, it was a pretty well wooded area, not up on the road, and the road we had, the big holes in them. I'd come up to tell my mother and the rest of the family that my daughter was born and that she was doing okay. And Dr. Johnson, A. Holmes, Dr. Bob's dad, was the doctor for that. And of course there was no lights. What they had used, they had a flashlight with a green paper over the lens. And that's what the only light we had to form anything that they had to be. There was no bright lights or anything. When I was home ashore, between trips, I joined a patrol here, and you had a life where you walked the beaches to be sure there was nobody coming in. So you did that in between times, and then there was what you call blackouts. You had this black building paper, roofing paper, that they over your windows, and you couldn't use no lamps at night. And of course, everybody walking around, you'd be trying to identify yourself with them, and you'd always say something. And you had also had the green light. Like a flashlight, the green cover, flashlight, a paper.
How did it change for citizens of Kodiak? Did this permanently change, kind of like what people did for a living, living through this war? Or you described the town as maybe a couple of hundred people to maybe 450 people. Did the war bring about a big change just from people being here and wanting to come back? Or?
Well, the town started to grow after that. I would say we branched out into more commercial, we're getting into the crab industry. And we got as many as they would start moving in. Like I mentioned too, we wound up in the late 50s, 60s, with as high as 13 cannabis here. Because of the year round, we got into the crab season, king crab season. Then you run into a salmon season. Then you run into a halibut season. Then there was the herring season. Then you went into a tanner crab season. And then you went in Dungeness crab. So it's kind of year-round occupation, like it is today, except that it's harder to get what they want. And they have to diversify so much. Of course, now they have all this gear, so the town built up fairly fast after that. And that's what started it. Building up as a Navy base. There was construction for quite a few years, and there was quite a civilian path after that. I'd say there was about 6,000 people involved between civilian family and military.
Now, was the Navy base there right at the beginning of the war, or was that something that came along later? I know you mentioned the Army was important.
Well, the Army was more or less in town here, town section, where City Dock is now, what is now City Dock. And the, of course, General Collette and Major Collette and a few of those officers, which were Army, were up here where the housing area back, but they didn't have anything great to go, mostly Navy. It was originally a Navy base.
Uh-huh. Was that Navy base here before the war? And if so, how,
well, when
about
we,
when?
When we started the dredging in 37, surveying and dredging, it was Cedar Drake Construction Company came in. That was being planned for the Navy then, and it was slowly developing like that. And then, of course, when the war came around, 40s, they must have known something because.
Wasn't there Army town and right around the bend was Navy?
That's what I mentioned, this Army housing town here.
And then it was almost.
That was a second. It wasn't the Navy base where the Woman Bay area is now today. The
Coast Guard base today.
Coast Guard base today. The Army was over where this housing project was. I'm just talking about by Lake Louise.
Yeah, or by maybe where the. The Buskin,
that's right.
Where all those cement pads are, back along the Buskin Road, was that housing back then?
Yeah, but where all those.
But that was civilian and navy.
Are,
that was civilian and navy. That was not army.
Well, when you folks took me
out
of my heat pits, George, that's where it was. Right where the army town was on this side, and going right up around the bend where the guardhouse is now to go into the Coast Guard, that was Navy.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's Navy there. But Navy was the
Nimitz,
big park.
Nimitz Park was Army.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
This was Army.
Uh-huh.
But there wasn't many people, troops here at all. There was a Marine Corps and Navy.
Okay, I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Army was like, the only part the Army played into it is like, I have mentioned that part of that I got into it was called the harbor craft. And it was the protection and hauling of supplies, men and materials around the island for watching for Japanese. And the Navy was doing everything.
I wanted to ask you too, since you were involved in some of the dredging, there was a submarine base here, wasn't there? Or submarine pens, or I'm not sure if it's repair area.
No. Any submarine that came in here would have to come in surface. There's no way you can get into that base surface. Your depth, your water depth today, is not over 35 feet. And you need plenty more than that. In fact, your big ships like the tanker that comes in at Tulip at the base, he has to come in at high tide in order to get into the base. Then of course when you unload, you can go out to a foot. But not any depth. You couldn't bring a cruiser in there. You could bring a destroyer in there, but not a cruiser, not a deep enough.
Okay, I wanted to ask you, how did the natives on Kodiak, the Kodiak natives, how did they, did their lifestyles change because of the war, or did it more or less stay the same for them? How were they affected?
Well, it was universal. They were around here. They worked the canneries during the summer, which was seasonal. And a lot of them were fishermen, of course, they did the fishing. Life around here for them was pretty good. They didn't have to move out like they did out the chain, out west. We call that the chain.
Yeah.
They didn't have to move out there and take them down to southeastern like they did. But when they brought them from Adak and Kiskan and places, and they brought them in, putting here, I think it was about 1,200 of them. I suppose they got about 12,000 apiece of them taken away from the home. We didn't have anything like that. In fact, the night that the Japs were supposed to fly over here, my daughter was on December 27th, 1941. The only thing that had stopped them. It turned foggy. We had the weather was kind of sloppy. They couldn't very well see their way. They were on the way, but they weren't from what I gather from different people that I've talked to, including some of the military officers who were in there, they were within 45 minutes of Kodiak when they turned back. And one of the reasons was when they hit bombed the Northwestern at Dutch Harbor. That's one of the boats the pilot was in there. When they bombed the Dutch Harbor, the American aircraft came in from the west side. And the Japs thought that we had another airfield for the west. So they retreated. One of the reasons that they retreated instead of advancing further this way, from Dutch Harbor this way. And they never attempted to come to Kodiak anymore, just that one night. And the weather played a big role. There's always a lot of fog in the country that time of year. You wouldn't know it now.
Okay, what do you think were the greatest changes that happened in Kodiak because of the war? And maybe we've answered this before, I'm not sure.
Well, everybody coming in, it was due to the fishing industry that you see involved today. It started out in the early 50s, and it's been going ever since. Mm-hmm. And one season after another.
Not much to do with the war then?
No, not at all. The war, in fact, after the defense was the shrimp fishing. You could go out here behind Long Island, which is about a 45 minute run. You used to go out there and drag. They had big drags instead of pots. They dragged for an hour and a half to 2 hours and come in with 130, 140,000 pounds. That time at all. Then knowing the industry we had here, because then we started getting more and more outside fishermen coming in all the time, quite competitive, which brought us into the we have had 16 champions here, 12, 16. And brought them all in, and of course they brought the price down too, because the volume was so great, everybody made good money, and they finished off the shrimp, because that poor thing is eaten by halibut, salmon, codfish, gulla, humans, people, and the little hairy sea otter. They love sweet. Clams also. They're also hard on the clam patch, like the bears are. And so the shrimp season didn't last probably about 12 or 15 years. And they had to go further and further and further. And they finally got to where they were. Let's see, three, 4 inches, they were down to maybe about a half, maybe 3/4 of an inch long. And that's the way they are today. Shrimp fishery, although they multiply very fast, but they haven't picked up yet. And same thing with the king crab. The king crab used to drag for king crab with nothing but a big seine or a form of pot and pull on that and bring it up and load your boat up in a couple of hours. And days have come also. That's why they're back to pot fish.
Uh-huh. I wanted to ask you too. You know, we said we had a cannery here and maybe another small one down by the ferry dock. When did the canneries start bringing Filipino or Chinese help into Kodiak? Was that at the very beginning, the very first cannery, or was that later?
There was no Chinese here. We had, in here in Kodiak, we had the Japanese fishermen, believe it or not, cannery workers, back in the early 30s. And then they brought the Filipinos in. We never had any Chinese. Now you've got Filipinos, and you've got Mexicans, and you've got the other ones.
Korean.
Huh?
Korean.
Oh, you got Korean, but you also have another group in here. They're big husky ones. Where is Lisa from?
Samoans.
Uh-huh.
And there are a few of them here. don't know, it just keeps more and more. You go up on the Willow Street, it's like the whole street is up here. So, but that was not
okay. Is there, we're down to the last question that I have on my sheet, George, and is there anything that you think is important to let me know about regarding World War II that we haven't talked about?
Nothing comes to me right by off the bat. That was all pretty routine for the gift of income from fishing, to the war area, after civilian life and fishing. That's just about the way it went, except the population now is, of course, 13, 14,000, and with the military as well, about 17, 18,000. So it's just been a smooth transition. The villages around the island, of course, are like the harbor, for instance, on the east side there. They have a couple, they have a floating family there, and they, and over in Larson Bay, and that's also gave them their livelihood, and they just had a season of 3 or 4 months too, during the war. And that's their full best, just like you see in today's modern times. I can't think of anything. You don't have any more questions?
One hardship that I had really had, remember, was when people wanted to leave on the boats, we didn't fly out here, then they had passenger boats, and you never knew when they were going to be coming in. They just tell you within 2 days, and they have to come in during the night, and they have to be all packed up and ready to travel.
Yeah, that was your passenger ship.
Yeah.
That was strictly.
It was all secret.
They came in. When they came in, they didn't know before they were at the dock, and then when they left at night. But I understand the Japanese have pictures of the ships leaving here. And when they got out in Chinook Bay, they knew they were loaded with their children, but they hadn't been touched much. This started as a rumor, and it never had changed. I never heard anybody say that was false or otherwise. But it's supposed to be well documented, because if they did, he was just leaving. And that was the old Alaska steamship leaks, the forges. And we only used to get them once every six weeks. One ship every 6 weeks. And that brought everything. We didn't have no fresh beef or anything like that. It was salt, barrels, brine butter and barrels. Corned beef in barrels. If you wanted anything, you had your own chickens, you had your own eggs, you raised your own cattle, and then you had your eggs too. The sergeants had theirs, and so it wasn't a marketing
thing. My dad worked at the butcher shop.
If you were lucky enough. Huh?
The crafts had their own, they had two cows.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, there was no butcher shops.
My dad worked in the butcher shop.
When did he come over? 40?
39. When I came over, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I just wanted to.
I guess I missed a couple of years.
Yeah, I just wanted to paint a picture of the years before the war.
Okay, well, thank you, George. Yeah. I appreciate you sharing our time here and giving me this information.
I hope it's been some help to you. If you think of any more, give me a call.
Okay.